From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. The NFL has been scandal-ridden in recent months. Domestic violence charges have been brought against prominent players, and last weekend there were DEA visits to five of the league's teams. Those stories ahead on Only a Game. Also, the uncertain fate of a deluxe Brazilian stadium used only a handful of times at the 2014 World Cup, and a new study explores why jazz music is lay-down, breakdown, birdie on the hot side of town for golfers who want to improve their putting. Also ahead, the 1972-73 Philadelphia 76ers posted a 9-73 record, the worst in NBA history. But why were they proud of it?
They didn't want their record to be broken. They wanted to be the worst team of all time. It was something that made people talk about them.
Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. The NFL Players Union has appealed Minnesota Vikings running back Adrian Peterson's NFL suspension, calling it unprecedented, arbitrary, and unlawful. Peterson told USA Today that he's learned better ways of disciplining his children after entering a no-contest plea to reckless assault of a child. Meanwhile, former Baltimore Ravens running back Ray Rice expects word by Thanksgiving on his appeal of his NFL suspension for assaulting his wife in February. While the NFL sorts out issues of crimes and punishment, New York Times sports reporter Steve Eder has been investigating domestic violence in the NFL from the victim's perspective. Eder's two-part series is titled Nowhere to Turn. Steve, welcome to Only a Game.
Happy to be here.
You describe a very cozy relationship between NFL teams and various law enforcement agencies. In some cases, local police or sheriff's deputies are actually on the payroll of the NFL teams. How has that contributed to this issue?
Yeah, in one of the cases that we looked at, there was a Miami Dolphin who had been arrested, domestic violence case. After the arrest, the Dolphin security head was on the phone with people who worked for the team who were also sheriff's deputies. You know, the player was released out of a back door of the jail. He was able to avoid media. He was driven to the Miami Dolphins training facilities where he met with coaches in a patrol car. And then, you know, in that same unmarked car with an officer driving to his home. And, you know, it gave a sense, and the sheriff at the time found it to be too cozy. Teams need security, sure. And so it wouldn't be surprising that they would go out and they would hire local law enforcement to serve in those capacities. The question is when it becomes something more. That's something that, you know, that we looked at and I think will continue to be looked at, those relationships.
Some teams also discouraged women from going to the police in the first place, sometimes assigning a team employee to be available day and night to diffuse arguments, almost like an on-call marriage counselor. I assume this wasn't done with a women's safety in mind.
You're referring to a case involving a Cincinnati Bengals player and his ex-wife. And in that case, the ex-wife and later also spoke with the player, and they explained that the message from the team was, keep it in-house. The team has denied it, but you sort of see from there that there's a lot of involvement from the team in this couple's marriage when they're having problems. It describes a culture where distractions and things like that are a problem.
You spoke with Brandi Underwood, who was married to former Green Bay Packers safety Brandon Underwood. She said the supportive community of Packers' wives became significantly less supportive when the abuse in her relationship became public. What happened, and was peer pressure a common theme among the women you interviewed?
I think so. And in the case of what Brandi told us, she had had a couple things happen in her relationship. There was an allegation with her ex-husband involving other women and a prostitution issue. And, you know, what she described is people basically saying, you know, this is part of what we deal with, you know, move on and forgive and forget and stay with them. It'd be better for your kids and all that kind of stuff. And she felt that a feeling of being really stuck, you know, who do you turn to and who can you really trust and who's going to give you advice for what's good for you?
She was also the woman who got the call after she had left her husband from another woman saying, you're so strong, you're so brave, I wish I could do that too.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, that's part of what was intriguing about what Brandi Underwood had to say was she described how very difficult it was to break away, the financial aspects of it, the cultural aspects of breaking away. But, you know, she's moved on 3 years down the road, and she says she looks back and she wishes that she could sort of see the person that she is now, and how much stronger she is now.
Some people would say that things are changing in the league. NFL Executive VP of Football Operations Troy Vincent, whose mother was a domestic violence victim herself, helped to coordinate player involvement in a new anti-domestic violence ad campaign that runs during games on television.
No more. Not my problem.
No more.
But he has such a bright future. No more he didn't mean it.
The ads are moving, but after all you've learned about the culture that covers up domestic violence in the NFL, does the league's involvement in this campaign feel sincere to you?
Well, look, certainly there's a focus on this now, and the things that we've looked at are, they are recent cases, but, you know, things have changed as it relates to this discussion since the Ray Rice case came to light a couple months back now. So I think it's hard to sort of discuss the sincerity of it, but I think certainly you could say that the NFL is focused on it, and it's something that's, you know, become a front burner issue and a whole lot of discussion around it.
Steve Eder writes about sports for the New York Times. You can link to his series Nowhere to Turn at onlyagame.org. Steve, thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you.
The Federal Drug Enforcement Administration added to the NFL's PR woes. Last weekend, agents surprised the medical staffs of five teams with inspections related to the handling and use of prescription drugs. ESPN's John Barr has been writing about prescription painkiller abuse in the NFL for Outside the Lines for the past few years. John, can other teams expect the federal government to come calling soon?
That's a good question. We don't know whether the Drug Enforcement Administration is planning any more of these, you know, quote-unquote surprise inspections. Clearly, they delivered a message on Sunday to teams that go on the road, where teams have gotten into a little bit of a pickle in recent years, is some doctors have taken drugs on the road, and that's against the law. You just can't transport controlled substances across state lines, and you can't hand out medication in areas where you're not registered with the DEA to do so.
I don't want to overstate the significance of these inspections. They seem to be mostly a matter of paperwork. Do these types of technicalities really get to the heart of the problem of prescription drug abuse in the NFL?
Well, probably not, and simply because as teams have gotten better about following the law and as doctors have played by the book, so to speak, players are going elsewhere. NFL linemen in particular rely on prescription pain medication to get through the week. They live with pain, and many of these former players, as has been reported extensively, live with chronic pain, and those are the types of individuals who unfortunately become susceptible to addiction.
The DEA was responding to a federal lawsuit filed by 10 named plaintiffs, including three members of the 1985 Chicago Bears Super Bowl team. What do those players allege?
Well, they allege that they were given medications during their playing days and that the team medical staff failed to adequately disclose to them the dangers and the risks of taking the medication. You know, Keith Van Horn, one of those members of the celebrated 85 Chicago Bears Super Bowl team that you mentioned, you know, he alleged that he played with a broken leg for an entire year and was fed a steady diet of pain medication to get through the year. And, you know, now fast forward all these years later, a lot of these individuals are left with debilitating injuries, lingering pain, and some of them, unfortunately, fall into the spiral of addiction.
The NFL has filed a motion for dismissal of that lawsuit, but assuming the case is allowed to go forward, are we likely to see thousands more former players suing their former employers?
Well, there are more than 1,300 at the current count, and my understanding from speaking with the attorney who's dutifully watching that Excel spreadsheet to see if more names are added, a gentleman by the name of Phil Closius in Baltimore, if the suit isn't tossed out, it likely won't be until the spring that the court determines whether this case will be certified as a class action. So as it stands today, more than 1,300 players, former players, have indicated they're ready to sign on, and I would have to believe there will be more.
John Barr is an ESPN investigative reporter. John, thank you very much for joining me.
My pleasure.
From 2010 to 2013, the Toronto Raptors finished at or near the bottom of the NBA's Atlantic Division. But last year, the team won the division, and if their strong start is any indication, they may do it again this season. Joining me to discuss Toronto's turnaround is the Toronto Star's Doug Smith. Doug, NBA teams typically change their fortunes either by signing superstar free agents or tanking and then rebuilding through the draft. Can the Raptors' turnaround be explained that simply?
I wish it could, because it would make it way easier for me to write about them. But the turnaround was just internal growth. They haven't added a superstar. Really, DeMar DeRozan has emerged as an all-star player, but certainly not in the top 10 in the NBA. They did it the old-fashioned way. They built through themselves. They got young kids and let them grow together, and they were patient. And luckily, they had fans who stayed patient with them.
Toronto is, of course, home to the NHL's much-loved Maple Leafs. How are Torontonians dividing their attention between the two teams now that the Raptors are good?
The Leafs are horrible, and basketball is almost taking over. It's amazing to see the dynamic up here now, because there aren't a lot of people who sit around on Saturday nights with their dad watching the Maple Leafs on TV anymore. The Raptors are, you know, they're drawing 19,800 people a night pretty much this season. Bill, if you remember last year in the playoffs against Brooklyn, they would have upwards of 10,000 people outside the arena watching on big screen televisions during the games. The city loves a winner, and this basketball team, since the middle of last year, has been consistently winning.
Point guard Kyle Lowry has been in the NBA for 10 seasons, but it wasn't until he came to Toronto 3 years ago that he started putting up big numbers. As a Raptor, he's averaging 15 points and 7 assists per game. Is this a matter of Lowry getting better after 7 years, or the Raptors just being a better fit?
I think it's mostly maturation on his part. He was a very young, impetuous, moody kind of young fellow when he got here, and they calmed him down. And the coach, Dwayne Casey, sort of gave him his head. Go and do what you do best, and he's done it well.
In 2013, Grammy Award-winning rapper Drake, who's a native of Toronto, became the team's global ambassador. I'm quoting when I say that. Aside from his sitting courtside during games sometimes, what does that mean?
It means he sits at courtside during games and handshakes the players when they go on the floor. That's pretty much it. You know, he does give them a cachet. The young kids know him. He doesn't do anything, really, but he's around the team to help out and give it a profile with young fans and, frankly, with other NBA players. If he's out there meeting with guys who are going to be free agents and being their friend, it certainly doesn't hurt the franchise.
The Raptors have more than a few international players on the roster. Being the lone NBA team outside the U.S., is that something the franchise embraces?
It is. Toronto is such a diverse city that the players who come from Europe or Asia or South America, they fit better in this city, I think, than they would in a lot of American cities. Mm-hmm. There's a large population base of Lithuanians, for instance, that help out Jonas Valanciunas and his acclimation in North America. Rivas Vasquez is from Venezuela, and there's a big group here to support him. It makes it easier for players to make that transition from Europe or South America to the North American lifestyle.
Last year, the Raptors were eliminated in the first round of the playoffs. I know it's still very early, but is this a Raptors team built to go beyond that first round?
It is. They know what it takes now to play in a playoff. There was a lot of deer in the headlight time last year in that first round of the playoff series that won't be there this year. You know, they're a year older, a year more experienced. So this team was built to go at least one round and maybe as far as the conference finals this year.
Toronto Star reporter Doug Smith has covered the Raptors since the team's inception in 1995, and his patience is paying off. Doug, thank you so much for speaking with me.
Bill, my pleasure entirely.
Coming up on Only a Game, the story of the worst NBA team ever to take the floor. But first, these are busy days for Major League Soccer. On Thursday, league officials in New York held meetings with four groups bidding to own the next expansion team, and the league's conference championships get underway this weekend. In the East, it's the New York Red Bulls against the New England Revolution, and in the West, the Seattle Sounders face the LA Galaxy. Joining me now is Don Ruiz, who covers the Seattle Sounders for the News Tribune in Tacoma, Washington. Welcome back. Only a game.
My pleasure. Thanks a lot.
Each conference championship is a two-game series in which total goals is the key. Let's start in the West. Seattle has built the greatest fan base in the league. Attendance there has been sensational, but the fans can't kick the ball into the goal. What sort of shape are the Sounders in for game one against the Galaxy?
The Sounders are in good shape. The only question mark is a huge one, and that's Osvaldo Alonso. Perhaps the best defensive midfielder in Major League Soccer, picked up a little bit of a thigh, upper hamstring kind of something. Ziggy Schmidt's never very specific on injuries. And then, of course, with the two-week break for international play, they have DeAndre Yedlin back with them. So the Sounders, Ziggy should be able to field either his first-choice 11 or certainly his first-choice 10 out of 11.
Don, MLS walks a line between U.S. and European sensibilities. For example, the Premiership in England does not have playoffs, but MLS does. Those playoffs began back on October 29th. They won't end until December, in part, to allow MLS players to fulfill commitments to their national teams. Has MLS got the balance right yet?
I think if a lot of soccer fans maybe were appointed king of Major League Soccer, they might do it differently. As a practical matter, MLS is going to have to kind of go against the world. The Sounders believe that while MLS Cup is the more prestigious trophy in MLS, that the Supporters Shield is the more meaningful, and therefore they are kind of taking their victory lap as having had the best season in MLS. Separate trophies, allowing the fans to kind of weigh them any way they like, is probably as good as it's going to get.
Let's turn to expansion. MLS wants to add a team by the year 2020. Four ownership groups are in the running, one from Las Vegas, one from Sacramento, and two from Minneapolis. The league will discuss the proposals again on December 6th. Do you have an educated guess regarding which city will win out?
I am going to say Minneapolis. I believe Sacramento has done about all that a city can do to make itself almost irresistible, but the one thing that they cannot do is take their city and shift it into the central time zone, and I believe that they want to get another team in the Midwest.
All right, time for the last question, and of course, that's prediction time. We're down to the Galaxy and the Sounders in the West, the Red Bulls and the Revolution in the East. Who wins it all this year?
Oh, man, I think I'm going to say the Sounders finally break through. It is almost Pavlovian to see the Galaxy on the other side of the pitch and think, okay, well, it ends here. But I think this is going to be one of those rare seasons, in fact, unprecedented season, of the triple. I think it'll be the Sounders adding an MLS Cup to go with their Supporters Shield and their U.S. Open Cup.
Don Ruiz covers the Seattle Sounders for the News Tribune in Tacoma, and no homer he, huh? Don, thanks very much for speaking with me.
Okay, you bet. My pleasure.
In July, the German men's national team lifted the 18-carat World Cup trophy in Rio de Janeiro's Maracanã Stadium after a suspenseful 1-0 victory over Argentina in the finals. The Maracanã, which was renovated for the World Cup, is iconic to soccer fans the world over and will continue to be used for soccer matches, but there is concern that there are no clear post-World Cup plans for some of the tournament's other 11 stadiums, especially the gleaming new stadium in the jungle city of Manaus. Sam Schramsky reports from Brazil.
Brazil's Amazon rainforest surrounds the concrete jungle of Manaus. In the heart of Manaus sits Arena Amazonia. The stadium was heavily scrutinized for its remoteness, construction costs and delays, and for the deaths of three workers. But when the World Cup began, the city on Brazil's distant frontier was giddy. Fans were overwhelmingly positive in the face of negative press. David Williams and Matt Townsend, engineers from Minnesota, emphasized this after the U.S.-Portugal match on June 22nd.
I thought it was phenomenal, except I'm a little disappointed with the fact that it's a tie.
It was a very beautiful stadium.
It was very well designed, and good security.
But Arena Amazonia only hosted four qualifying round matches and now sits empty, except for occasional games between a handful of Brazil's fourth-level D-series teams and three games featuring top-level teams from Rio and São Paulo. Manaus's mayor, Artur Virgilio Neto, admitted during the World Cup that the stadium might end up being underused, but he was optimistic about the potential for music concerts, such as Rock in Rio, organized by entrepreneur Roberto Medina.
It will be very good for international shows, and I hear that many pop stars have a dream of singing for low price in Amazon jungle. Mr. Medina, that is discussing with us, is the Rock in Rio. He wants to make here Rock in Rio jungle.
But no firm has been willing to go into a management partnership, let alone buy the stadium outright. Rock shows have yet to materialize, but Arena has hosted recent near-sellout evangelical Christian concerts. The fear is that once the novelty wears off, so will the revenue stream. The stadium costs more than $270 million, of which $160 million the state loaned from a federal bank. While that loan matures in 20 years with minimal interest, there's already cause for concern. Both the top soccer matches and concerts have been organized by events agencies, who've all paid less than half the recommended $122,000 rental fee needed to cover basic costs. Dr. Marcos Evangelista, president of the Regional Economic Council for Amazonas, points out that the costs and returns just don't add up.
To know for sure, with complete certainty, if it's going to be a white elephant or not, it's difficult to forecast because economists work with numbers. We don't have the numbers in hand to confirm or even do a projection for the future of the project.
And the numbers aren't just a matter of paying off a steep loan. Paying off these debts could mean shortfalls for state priorities, such as schools, hospitals, and basic sanitation. Not paying them off could lead the state to default, or more likely to go into a rotten public-private partnership. The state would foot most of the bill, and the corporate partner would maintain use of the structure at a bargain basement price. Governor José Melo, re-elected just last month, has so far refused to disclose results of a costly evaluation meant to explore the stadium's long-term viability. His office declined several requests for an interview on the matter. Dr. Evangelista is concerned.
We know that without the stadium being economically viable, this money is never going to be remunerated. For that to happen, it would take a long time, and many things have to change in order for it to become economically viable. The argument now is that the stadium is beautiful, that it's a tourist destination, but economically, in my opinion, it's totally unviable.
The stadium's strongest supporters disagree. Dr. Ali Almeida is the president of the Olympic Village Foundation, which operates Arena Amazonas. Almeida is convinced that it has great potential as a multi-use venue and uses examples of stadiums in the U.S. and Europe to make his case.
These days, stadiums are multi-use. In the United States, your country, the American Football Stadium hosts shows for the Rolling Stones and Shakira. American football stadiums also for shows, not just American football. In Barcelona, 40% of the revenue comes from shows. It doesn't come from football. There are events outside football because the stadiums are multi-use. And our stadium has 17 events in 5 months.
Almeida believes a private operator will eventually purchase the stadium, in which case the state would only suffer a slight loss. He says his optimistic outlook is shared by the citizens of Amazonas.
The Amazonian has pride for his arena. The claims of white elephants have already gone away under our management, under this government, under the government of Professor José Melo, and it will not be a white elephant.
Renato de Souza is a street vendor in Manaus. He estimates he makes about $3 a day in profits. He says that in the several years he's worked the area around the stadium, not much has changed.
A lot of people complain about the stadium. There are those who support it and those who complain about it. It's all politics, you know? A politician is the kind of person who, after they win, just gets into a lot of corruption. These politicians, when they think they're going to make things better, they make things worse. This is the way we see things. These days, it's everyone out for themselves.
Coming off a Brazilian national election that put the cost of living and government spending in high relief, any future operator of Arena Amazonia will have plenty of work ahead of them and a force of skeptics to prove wrong. For Only a Game, I'm Sam Shramsky in Manaus.
Perhaps the most surprising statistic from the Philadelphia 76ers' 1972-73 season comes from 1 6-day stretch in February during which the Sixers won 3 times, because over the months before that stretch and the months that followed, Philadelphia won only 6 games. Those Sixers weren't bad. They were awful, which accounts for the title of Charlie Rosen's newest book, Perfectly Awful. Charlie, welcome back to Only a Game.
Well, thank you for having me.
You write that by November 1st, after the Sixers had begun the season 0-10, the team was, quote, gripped with an abiding sense of gloom. Did everybody involved with that team understand that early just how awful the season was going to be?
They understood that the first time they met their coach, Roy Rubin, before practice started in training camp, where he went through a whole spiel about what a disciplinarian he was, and then he said, and no smoking in the locker room, no exceptions. And one of the players, Freddie Carter, who was a veteran, raised his hand and said, Coach, I got to smoke. It's the only way I can calm down. I have to smoke during halftime. And Rubin said, well, okay, you can smoke and nobody else. And the guys looked at each other and said, uh-oh, this is going to be a long season.
Roy Rubin, as you mentioned, the head coach, was known throughout the basketball world, I guess, as poor Roy Rubin. Was he a victim in this dark comedy or one of its architects, ultimately?
He was definitely not a victim. He was a very good high school coach in the Bronx in New York and a good coach at LIU in Brooklyn. But the pros, he didn't know how to deal with players. He'd come into the locker room at halftime, where there's like a 15-minute intermission, and say, okay, keep hustling, and then turn to his assistant coach, Paul Lizzo, and say, how much time do we have left? He used to yell at players for missing a shot. He said, why did you take that shot? I was open, but you missed it. Why did you take it? It was just absurd. He had no business coaching at that level.
Because it is perhaps illustrative of the weirdness of the 72-73 season in Philadelphia, I want you to tell the story of the night Coach Rubin tried to substitute John Q. Trapp out of a game and then very quickly changed his mind.
Well, John Q. was a strange character. He was a scary guy. One of the writers said he had won a bronze medal in Vietnam, and he was more afraid of Trapp than he was when he was in Vietnam. So Trapp is from Detroit, and they're playing in Detroit, and all his boys are there sitting behind the bench. During a timeout, Rubin says, okay, have a seat. Dave Sorensen, you go in for Trapp. And Trapp says, no. And Rubin says, no, what do you mean? So Trapp turns around, looks behind him. One of his guys stands up, opens up his coat, and shows a gun. And Rubin says, oh, okay, stay in the game.
Eventually, and unsurprisingly, Roy Rubin was fired. At the end of January, Kevin Lockery became the player coach, and he said, if we're going to lose, I'd rather lose with good guys. What bad guys got cut, and did any of their good guy replacements help very much?
Well, he was there on the team bus heading to the airport, and he told the team that he had just cut John Trapp, and they all applauded. So that was one bad guy he got rid of. Yeah, they got Tom Van Arsdale in a trade, who really, really helped them. But I think the funniest line was when Lockery had his press conference in Chicago at the All-Star game, taking over the team. They were 4-47, and some reporter asked him, what will it take for your team to make the playoffs? And Lockery said, 3 airplane crashes.
It's not funny, but it's funny, I guess.
Yeah, right.
I think it's worth mentioning that Roy Rubin himself did find work at which he was of more use than he had been in Philadelphia, or at least that's the way he saw it, right?
Yeah, he was down in Miami. He moved down to Miami, and he was counseling at-risk kids and working in community centers, which he said that did much more good than coaching the Sixers. If he would have just gone around picking garbage off the street, that would have done much more good than he did coaching the Sixers.
Charlie, in the epilogue to Perfectly Awful, you suggest that the 2011-2012 Charlotte Bobcats, who went an imposing 7-59 in a shortened season, might have been a worse team than the 76ers of 72-73. What compelled you to dig up something halfway positive to say about that Philadelphia team?
Well, there are a lot of positive things to say about them. They stuck together. They really didn't point fingers at each other, and they did play hard. They didn't really tank. I mean, in those days, the two teams with the worst records would have a coin flip to determine who got the number one pick. So it wasn't automatic that they would get the first pick. The problem is they couldn't make any stops in the last 3 or 4 minutes of the game. So they would play close and play close, and it's like a mental thing. It's like, okay, what's going to happen now? How are we going to screw up? Who's going to make the mistake that costs us the game? And when you think like that, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy.
The current Philadelphia team, I hate to say it, and maybe it's too early to say it, but they seem to be channeling the 72-73 Sixers. They, too, opened the season 0-11. Do you think whatever old-timers remain are rooting for this current team to be better, or I should say worse, than they were 41 years ago?
You know, strangely, most of the guys I spoke to, and Roy Rubin had said this before he passed away about a year and a half ago, that they didn't want their record to be broken. They wanted to be the worst team of all time. It was something that defined them, that made people talk about them, as I'm sure is happening in Philadelphia now. I'm sure they're talking about that team.
Charlie Rosen is the author of more than a dozen sports books, the most recent of which is Perfectly Awful, The Philadelphia 76ers Horrendous and Hilarious 1972-1973 Season. Charlie, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Bill.
To read a perfectly wonderful excerpt from Perfectly Awful and my perfectly adequate review of Perfectly Awful, please check them out at onlyagame.org. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, if your short game's not good, perhaps you should drop some Miles Davis or Ella Fitzgerald into your golf bag. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
On Thursday, Erie County Executive Mark Poloncarz told the media, if the NFL is trying to push the Bills to hold a football game while we're in the middle of an emergency, shame on the NFL. Soon afterwards, the NFL announced that the Buffalo Bills and the New York Jets would play in Detroit on Monday instead. Good call?
I think it's a pretty good call. It's interesting that they just didn't move a few miles down the road to Syracuse. I know those people are hardy, but I think piling into the old SUV and driving through 8 feet of snow to Detroit to see a home game is beyond even the Buffalo fans.
The NFL announced late Friday that Minnesota Vikings running back Adrian Peterson's appeal will be heard by Harold Henderson, who previously served as the league's VP for labor relations. The Players Association responded by saying nobody that closely connected with the league could be considered independent. Meanwhile, Commissioner Roger Goodell had cited a lack of remorse when he suspended Peterson for the remainder of the season. Does what Peterson said on Thursday qualify as remorse?
Not really. I mean, he was explaining, he apologized to his son after beating him so hard that they left marks on the legs. Apparently, you know, he's remorseful to his child. What Goodell wants, I think, is a public shaming, and he hasn't gotten that so far, which is another reason why this case should go before an independent arbiter.
Charlie, the Only a Game curse has struck again. Last week, we reported on the Oakland Raiders' quest for an 0-16 season, and this week, that previously hapless team beat the Kansas City Chiefs. Should we offer our regrets or our congratulations? I'm not quite sure what to do here.
Well, I mean, they're still in the running for the right to destroy whoever the next first pick in the draft is.
That's true.
So, no, the Raiders would be just as bad at 1-10 as they would be at 0-11.
This week, Jason Collins became the first openly gay player to retire from the NBA. His retirement was no surprise, and it had nothing to do with the fact that he's gay, as I understand it. Am I right?
Yeah, pretty much. It had to do with the fact that he's old and he's, you know, done his career. Now it's time to go.
One of your favorite men's basketball coaches, John Calipari, appears to have a pretty good team again this season. Top-ranked Kentucky beat number 5 Kansas by 32 points in the State Farm Champions Classic on Tuesday night. You couldn't be happier for Coach Cal, right?
Well, I'm telling you, when you know how to shop, you can get what you want. My favorite thing was Bill Self from Kansas, who was also supposed to have a pretty good team this year, who said he went from the water bottle and said, I was hoping this was vodka.
It seems like only last week that you and I were agreeing that the University of Connecticut women's basketball team would be ranked number 1 throughout the season. Do you suppose we jinxed them as well?
I think we did, because Stanford beat them, yep. 88-86, in what must have been a heck of a game. You know, it will come down once again to the entire world against UConn for the women's championship, and I suspect once again the entire world will lose. But this was an interesting development.
It is unusual for a girls' high school basketball team to score 98 points, and it's even more unusual for a girls' high school basketball team to score no points at all. So it must have been gruesome when each of those things happened in the same game.
The great thing about it, this happened in Corpus Christi in Texas, and Mathis High beat Kingsville 98-0 in a, you know, beginning of the season game. But the great thing about it is, if you read the reports, it's all about how nobody believed the score and kept calling the newspaper to ask him if it was a typo.
Columbus Blue Jackets defenseman Jack Johnson is not the first highly paid pro athlete to file for bankruptcy, Charlie, but his story does have an especially unfortunate twist.
Yeah. Apparently, you know, it is said that Jack Johnson was led astray by wrong company. Unfortunately, two of the people that led him astray were his parents. Apparently, his mother borrowed $15 million in his name in high-interest loans. It's extraordinary. Now, he's 27 years old, and he's completely broke.
The Oakland A's signed Pat Vendetti this week. Would it be an overstatement to say that by doing so, they picked up two pitchers?
Yeah, this is the latest guy. Greg Harris from the Red Sox, you may recall, did this, who can throw with either hand.
Right.
The Red Sox went, harumph, it's beneath the dignity of the game, and wouldn't let him do it.
Correct.
If I were the Oakland A's, I'd let him start a game in the first inning left-handed and then right-handed and the left inning right-handed, because baseball, once again, will step on itself rather than do the smart thing.
Or at least the thing that provokes fun.
That people want to have fun with,
exactly.
Yes.
Jose Canseco. All I had to do was say Jose Canseco. Anyway, it wasn't funny when he shot off his finger while he was simultaneously cleaning four guns. Then,
oh, yes, it was.
Well, no, not
the
for
four
him.
Guns is what makes it funny.
He then tweeted a video of the finger falling off while he was playing poker, but that turned out to be a prank. So what has Jose done for an encore?
He's explaining. I can't get through this. He has decided that we Earthlings should harness the power of comets to travel around the universe. He's tweeting away about it, including this one. If Earth can control the comet transport system, we will run the Milky Way. Think about that. Nah, he's nuts.
Correct me if I'm wrong here, but my understanding is that this week the Canadian Football League has provided an answer to the question, how do you know when it's too cold out to play football?
The footballs explode!
Break.
They crack, they break, they fall apart. And the Edmonton Eskimos are one game away from the Grey Cup, and they have to play football even though it's in November, and they're in Edmonton. And what happens? The footballs explode!
And finally, Charlie, the students at USC were apparently worried that before the weekend's big game against UCLA, students from UCLA would vandalize various USC campus landmarks. So was the reasoning that they should vandalize the landmarks themselves before the enemy could do it?
Yeah, they covered all of the statues with duct tape, therefore showing, ha, we can do this better than you guys can.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce at Grantland, and he joins me each week on Only a Game as well. Thank you, Charlie.
And the footballs explode!
And they tape them up with duct tape. No problem. Despite Boston's well-earned reputation as a hockey town, no team from the city has ever won the NCAA women's ice hockey title. But that could change this year. Three squads from Boston are currently ranked among the nation's top seven. Number one ranked Boston College, number six Harvard, and number seven Boston University. Only a Game's Martin Kessler has more on how the return of five Olympians to these teams could help bring an end to the Midwest's dominance of women's college hockey.
Four colleges from Boston have competed in the annual Beanpot to determine which women's ice hockey team is the best in the city. But this season, there seems to be even more at stake. The BC Eagles are coached by Katie Crowley.
You're jockeying for who's going to win that first national championship.
The city's high expectations can be largely attributed to the return of five elite players from the 2014 Sochi Olympics in Russia. Of the seven skaters from the American and Canadian national teams who are now back in the U.S. playing college hockey, five are in Boston. One at Northeastern, one at BU, one at BC, and two at Harvard. Just last February, they were competing on hockey's biggest stage. In the gold medal game, the U.S. went ahead 2-0, but Canada scored twice in the last 5 minutes of regulation to force overtime. Then, in the extra period, Canadian forward Marie-Philippe Poulin scored to give her team the win, and Canada its fourth straight gold medal.
It was really fun to bring back the gold to Canada, that's for sure. It's always special, I think. Yeah, you don't realize how many people you touch in their lives and where they were when they watched the game and like every emotion they went through. And now it put me right on cloud nine every time I get to talk about it.
Poulin's gold medal is stashed back home in Quebec, but she's now in Boston skating for Boston University. Poulin came out on top at the Olympics, but she hasn't been so fortunate in NCAA championship games. She's reached the title game twice with BU, but both times the Terriers fell to teams from the Midwest. First Wisconsin, and then Minnesota. Those two teams, along with Minnesota Duluth, have combined for all but one of the 14 NCAA titles. BC coach Katie Crowley.
The Midwest has, you have to say, dominated that national championship and national title. So that's definitely something that I know a lot of East Coast teams, you know, think about and want to keep here.
Playing style is a factor. While Eastern teams are known for speed and finesse, Midwestern squads tend to play a more physical and aggressive game. But with the Olympians back from a year devoted almost exclusively to training, Boston's teams may now match up better physically. Boston College and Team USA forward Alex Carpenter says the Olympic training has better prepared her for a more physical style of play.
I remember my first couple games of the national team, I would get knocked around, so
that was one of my main focuses, is not to get knocked around like that. And I think now that I'm more sturdy, both on and off the puck, I think that'll be an advantage for myself.
Harvard has added two players from Team USA, forward Lindsey Fry and defender Michelle Picard. But the team's biggest addition might be the return of head coach Katie Stone. She ended a streak of 19 consecutive seasons behind the Harvard bench by becoming the first woman to coach the U.S. national team at the Olympics. Now back in Cambridge, Stone thinks her two former Olympians bring more than their physical skills to the Crimson.
The best part of it is that we've got kids that have played at a high level with tremendous experience, and that's contagious.
Harvard junior forward Mie Dench, who led the Crimson in scoring last season, agrees. She's glad to have Fry and Picard back on her side.
When they step into the rink, you know, it's business, and they do what they need to do, and they never take a shift off or a day off or anything, and that's a great example to set for everyone else.
Harvard will get a chance to see just how much adding Olympic experience helps next weekend when they take on Northeastern in number one ranked Boston College. BC coach Katie Crowley knows her players have been eyeing that game against the Crimson.
I know our kids know on the schedule where Northeastern is, where BU is, where we play Harvard. Everyone's trying to be the best in Boston.
In this year, being the best in Boston could mean a national championship. For Only a Game, I'm Martin Kessler.
There are books about how to improve at golf, lots of books, and there are harnesses to help you keep your head down and gloves to make sure your grip doesn't slip and mantras for you to recite so your concentration never wavers at the top of your backswing. And then there is jazz. Here to explain the latest technique to help your game on the greens is Clarkson University Assistant Professor of Physical Therapy Ali Boulani. Welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you for having me.
First of all, tell us about the study you and four other researchers designed in order to explore the effect of music on putting and what conclusion you were able to draw.
What we did was we were interested in seeing if music genres impacted putting performance. So we had them perform putts from 5 feet away, and we had them in five different orders. So we had them go around in a random order, and we played music on random days. Okay. So they came in on multiple days, and then we measured their putting accuracy using the number of putts that they were able to sink. And we were only really able to do five from each spot because all of these golfers were very talented. They were all Division I golfers. So they learned the course very easily. Therefore, we had to limit the number of times that they could putt. And what we saw was with every music genre, it actually improved their putting, but jazz improved it the most.
Okay. Now, I understand that while everybody putted more effectively with music than without it, jazz was especially beneficial. How much improvement are we talking about?
Out of 25, they made an extra three. So on average, they were hitting a little over 14. And then when we had them putt with jazz, they were putting in about 17 strokes.
Wow. That sounds significant. Now, do you golf? And if so, have you figured out what's most beneficial for you to listen to on the greens?
Well, if you've ever seen my YouTube video, you'll know I'm absolutely horrible. And so I have to find whatever aids that I can. And I've tried different genres. Even then, I still get my butt kicked.
Golf Digest some time ago named Kenny G as the best musician/golfer. Maybe smooth jazz is the way to go.
Maybe. That's something that maybe I should go ahead and investigate, is looking at the different genres of jazz. But hey, that's what my job is, right? To try to figure answers out. Beauty of science.
I can't help but wonder whether at any point in your study, any of the golfers just put their hands over their ears and shouted, "Please make it stop."
You know, they might have done that a time or two, but I don't want any celebrities coming after me.
Do you anticipate that as a result of this study, golfers across the land will be putting on headphones or inserting earbuds when they reach the green?
Well, I hope not. I mean, you want to be able to hear four, right?
Oh, that's and a good point. Yeah.
So maybe just when they're practicing, and it can help them better read and, you know, think more clearly. But when they're playing, you might want to be a little careful. That golf ball comes at you pretty hard.
Absolutely. I'm wondering also whether, you know, everybody should have a playlist for all the different things you have to do on the course. You know, one selection for driving, another for the 5-iron to get you onto the green, and then, of course, into your jazz for putting.
You know, that's an excellent point. I'd never really thought about that. But I would think, you know, when you look at things such as running and such, high tempo music really impacts running and it increases running speed. So maybe with the drive, you could listen to high tempo music and you'd be able to drive farther. But that's a good point.
It really is feeling as if you better have further plans to study this whole thing. This is a career, right?
That's what I'm hoping. I mean, I'm hoping I can make a career out of studying golf and music and sports, I actually have some other studies in mind that I want to do with this, but I've got another couple right now that I'm working on looking at basketball jump shooting and music, as well as baseball and music.
Baseball and music. Tell me more.
Well, this was with college baseball players. We found that country music helped them hit home runs. We basically just had them hit balls that came out of a pitching machine, and it was basically like the home run derby. Probably didn't hurt that the study was done in Oklahoma with a lot of local Oklahoma guys. So, you know, that might have helped.
Ali Boulani is an assistant professor at Clarkson University, and his study, The Influence of Musical Genres on Putting Accuracy in Golf, was published in the Journal of Athletic Enhancement, and you can find a link to that study at onlyagame.org. Professor Boulani, thank you very much. This has been great fun.
Thank you. It's been a blast.
To check out Ali Boulani's putting form, please putter on over to facebook.com/onlyagamenpr. Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabue. Our technical director is James Trout. Our assistant producer is Martin Kessler. We had help this week from Dave Faniff, John Ferrati, and Joel Hurd at North Country Public Radio. Our intern is Eric Larrabee, and our senior producer is Gary Wallach. Our final word is from Clarkson University Assistant Professor of Physical Therapy, Ali Boulani. I told Mr. Boulani that I had witnessed his putting stroke on a video on the Clarkson website.
Well, now you know why I need jazz, right? I need all the help that I can get, so I had to find a way.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Thank you for listening. I'll see you next week.